Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Optics with Dr. Gabe Salguero in the nexus between faith and Hispanicity. And as we promised, we've been bringing topics that are so important to the Latino church in the United States, in particular, the Latino Evangelical Church. Last week, we had a financial expert talking about financial health and stewardship in the church. And today, we have a great, great surprise for you. We have Kevin Singer, who is the public relations leader for Springtide Research, and they have done great research. So take out your pen, your paper, your smartphone, wherever you take notes, your fallen Apple or your glorified Samsung, wherever you take notes, and we want to talk about mental health. It is an issue that the church cannot ignore, and in particular, with young people of color, Black, Indigenous, people of color. We have a mental health crisis. Just this week, Kevin, I saw in the New York Times, it was a leading headline in about mental health and that it preceded COVID-19. It started talking about mental health and social media. And so the New York Times has been talking about it. Springtide has done quite a bit of research, especially among young people of color and faith communities. So will you welcome to Optics in the nexus between faith and Hispanicity, Kevin Singer. Welcome, Kevin, and why don't you say hi to that beautiful audience of Optics.
Thank you so much, Gabriel. This is absolutely an honor. We were talking a little bit before we hit record about how large of a community we're talking about here, Latino evangelicals. And this is a community that I'm just so thrilled to have the chance to talk a little bit about our research and what we're finding in terms of young people of color, faith, and mental health. It's an intersection that you don't see a lot in research. And so it's a really unique study that we did. And I think your audience is really going to be challenged perhaps and even encouraged by some of the things that we're finding, because, you know, a lot of times in our culture, we talk about how mental health is perhaps transformative in a negative way, but the power of faith and the power of healing can be transformative in a positive way. And so I'm hoping that I'm not just here to be the bearer of bad news and, you know, oh, things are getting worse and worse and everyone needs to listen up, but hopefully audience members walk away feeling like, you know, whether they're a pastor or a lay person or someone in a youth leadership, that they can make a formidable impact on the young people in their congregations in the area of mental health.
Well, look, Kevin, we are thankful for what Springtide Research has done. We're thankful that not a lot of people have done this type of research of the nexus between faith and mental health. And right. Then you add that third layer, right? Faith communities of color, right? Hispanics being one, but African-American, Asian, and not just Christian. You talked about other faith traditions that have impacted for the better the mental health of young people of color. And the research, if I remember it well, is called Navigating Injustice, A Closer Look at Race, Faith, and Mental Health. A Closer Look at Faith, Race, and Mental Health. Those are, any one of those three topics is a world. It's just where the three tie. And then you're talking about young people. I'm telling every pastor, every denominational exec that listens to Optics, every youth pastor, every teacher and educator, that this is a research work unpacking. Recently, Jeanette and I were part of APA, American Psychiatric Association. There was a summit of faith and mental health, but not this degree of specificity around young people of color. And just like, let's whet our appetites, Kevin. Tell me what brought you to this and what were some of your initial learnings?
So a really, really amazing colleague of mine, Dr. Nabil Twemé, she led the study. She is Latina. And what brought her to this project, I know, is simply the fact that at any time you do research, you need to make sure you're studying something that is actually making a contribution to the field. And, you know, Springtide, when you look at everything we've done over the last few years, it's a bit to push back on some of these common narratives you see in the media, one of which is, you know, young people are the least religious generation yet. You know, they're all leaving the church. You know, don't expect any young people to come to your church. They're all becoming non-religious. And then you've got another narrative, which is, young people are drowning in mental health struggles. Nothing works. Nothing's helping. They're going to their smartphones and droves, but they're not finding healing or hope there. And for us, we're like, that's not good enough, because we still, as adults in society, have a responsibility to care for, guide, and walk alongside young people. Because if we're not doing that, then there's no future for the church. There's no future for any faith community. And so, some of the biggest learnings, I guess, if I could sum them up, is number one, faith has nothing but a positive relationship with mental health for young people. So, a lot of times what you see in media, if you're scrolling Twitter, is young people are facing, trauma and abuse in religious contexts. That's a very kind of hot narrative that young people are seeing, they're not finding healing in religious communities. They're only walking away with baggage, right? So that's the typical narrative. But when you look at our data, not only do most young people, and especially young people of color, identify as religious and spiritual, like 3/4 or more, but young people who are very spiritual or very religious, their mental health scores are formidably higher than young people who don't identify as religious. So like, religion still works.
Well, this is interesting, Kevin. I appreciate that fact, because that might shock people, especially people who are superficially talking about the subject, that young people who identify as deeply religious or deeply spiritual have increased, I don't know what the language is, I'm not a mental health professional, but they have better mental health. I remember when I was doing my PhD, there was a professor of psychology and faith, Dr. Ulanov, who talked about that faith is somehow connected, good faith, let's call it that, right? Good faith, healthy faith is connected to better mental health. And a lot of people don't know that, because it's almost counterintuitive to what we sometimes read in the headlines or see on Twitter or TikTok or all these other platforms.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too, to go to sort of the second major theme, is that race is good for mental health. So it's just faith that's good for mental health. Being in touch with one's racial or ethnic background, for a lot of the young people that we interviewed, their racial and ethnic identity, and I'm talking specifically about young people of color, was a source of purpose. In other words, it wasn't, and again, the hot narrative is, if I'm a person of color, that is trauma, right? Like, that's the idea, is that it brings nothing but discrimination and oppression. It's a very, very common idea, very common story. But what we're finding is young people saying, this is why I think God formed me this way. This is the witness, the testimony, the impact I've had on the basis of being part of this ethnic or racial group. And so when you, go ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
There's a lot
of misinformation about the impact of race or identifying with your race or your ethnicity on mental health.
Right.
Look, it's not lost on us that we've had, a season of global pandemic, racial tension, that's kind of the headlines in the news and in the media. But you're saying that if people embrace, hey, God made me.
Yes.
I didn't choose. I didn't choose to be born in an African-American family. Latino family. I didn't choose.
Right.
That's not a choice. You're born into the family you're born into.
Right.
The history and the both the racial, the ethnic history tied to it, that is a source of strength or source of, so now watch this, right? Because every time I go to a place and I say I'm Hispanic and I'm evangelical, right? I'm embracing both my kind of faith history and my racial cultural history, right? And both of those, I'm not either or, and I can't divide that from who I am. How did you see those things coming together to inform or frame the mental health of the young people?
So a lot of particularly white religious contexts, communities, leaders don't understand is you can't parse that. For a young person of color, and this comes straight from our data, they don't parse out their faith identity and their racial ethnic identity. They, for them, those things are deeply and intimately intertwined. And if you're like a first generation young person or second generation, like immigrant young person, they're virtually indistinguishable. Like, they can't imagine, being of a certain faith and not being of a certain race or vice versa. Like, those identities are so closely coupled. And so I think you know, what the obviously the clear implication is when we dumb down race because we feel like it's divisive, or because we feel like, well, we can't be a unified church community. You know, as Jesus said, I and the Father are one, I pray as they are one, as we are one. That oneness, it really has to take account for, it's got to be oneness and difference, because as soon as you begin to extinguish or make race or ethnicity invisible, you're telling young people that who you are, you can't be brought into this space. And then what happens if a young person can't bring them full selves into a space? Their mental health suffers. Like,
wow. Yeah. And look, I think you're talking, this is gospel in my, I call it my tradition, it's gospel, yeah. Right? It's unity, but not uniformity, right?
Right.
It's exactly. Pentecost. You are Asian, you are Hispanic, you are African-American.
Right.
And God created you that way and put you into that culture to make a particular contribution to the larger church, to the larger world. Why deny that? This kind of pseudo color blindness. I don't see color.
Yeah.
Which is,
oh yeah.
Tell me how did you engage these young people? What's the methodology?
Yeah.
Who were you talking to? How did you get them? What is the age range? Who is this group? And you're in optics with Dr. Gabe Salguero and Kevin Singer of Springtide Research. And we're talking about their great new report, Navigating Injustice. We're talking about race and faith and mental health. Three very important issues for the generation of millennials and Gen Zs and young people around the nation. And Kevin is talking to us. Who are the young people you spoke to, and what some of the stories came forward?
Yeah, this is about 3,100 13 to 25 year olds. So this is a lot of young people of color, right? And this is across a couple of years. So this isn't, you know, one snapshot, you know, 2 months into COVID. This is, you know, years in the making, this study. And then we had a comparison group of like 2,000 to 2,500 young white people. So we always do a comparison group, right? Because if you can't compare to another group, then you're left wondering how some of the data is significant.
Over 5,000 young people.
That's over 5,000. Yeah. That's over 5,000 young people. Yeah, it's a very impressively large study. And, you know, why do you survey 5,000 young people as opposed to 1,000? Because with each person you survey, you know, your data becomes increasingly reliable and what we call nationally representative. So you don't want to release what 25 young people of color think, because then you're left wondering, okay, well, can we really trust that? Well, with 3,000, you can say, okay, we can pull national trends out of this data. And fortunately, we were able to do that. I will say this. Without a shadow of a doubt, and this is all the mental health research we've done at Springtide, a lot of people think, you know, where do mental health challenges come from for young people, right? This is a question. And I think
pastors ask me that all the time.
Oh, where's it coming from?
Yeah. They write to my podcast. Where, you know, why now? Why is it increasing?
Yeah,
where's it coming
100%.
From? That's a great question.
I'll tell you, this is so many well-intentioned faith leaders totally missed the mark on this answer. So I think what a lot of people say, and I think this is very tempting for us older generations, is look at the thing they do that drives us crazy, right? Which is the phone. We're like, it's the phones, right? Like, if we just take away the phones, if we just ban TikTok. But here's the thing. Young people's mental health struggles, what we have found, comes predominantly from one place or two places. One, no sense of belonging anywhere in their life.
Hey, say that loud so the people in the back can hear.
You
heard it here on Optics.
No sense of belonging. Okay, of belonging. And the number two thing, and this might shock some people, no quality relationships with older adults.
Wow. Can you unpack both of those a little bit?
Yes.
Especially because this no sense of belonging, right? This kind of no man's land, no woman's land. It gives you kind of enemy, alienation, this sense of, you know, who am I? Whose am I? It's the kind of classic theological, you know, the Westminster Catechism for the Reformed folks, right?
Yes.
What is your only hope in life and in death? And your only hope in life and in death is that you belong to God, right? And so why now is this sense of non-belonging? What does your study or studies, because you have a list of studies reveal?
Yep. Well, I'll say this. And a lot of your listeners, I'm guessing if they're pastors in the evangelical tradition, they're men. If anyone understands what it means to not feel a sense of belonging in this culture and society, it's actually men. Huh. Like, men have few friends that are men, right? Like men don't have a lot of friends. And so hopefully people in your audience, if they are men, are thinking, I get that. I see that. I experienced that. Like, I'm not sure outside of maybe my marriage where I really feel a strong sense of belonging. Now, what is belonging? Belonging, well, I mean, it can be broken down really superficially, like a young person walking in and saying, do I belong here? And it's not just, did my parents take me here in a 2009 Toyota Islander, but like, do I belong here? And what is belonging? It's actually a really basic thing. We break it up into three ideas. The first is simply being noticed, right? Like, how many young people come inside and outside the doors of stuff and people kind of just dismiss them, right? Like, oh, they're just a teenager, lots of emotions, you know, like, you know, and we tend to talk about young people like that with other adults, right? Like, oh, how's it like raising teens, right? And it's, some of that is a bit of the fruit of the tree of dismissiveness. Like, we just don't see them. The second thing is naming them. And that doesn't mean just mean knowing their name, but do we actually know things about them? Do we remember things about them? And again, some of this sounds really basic and almost cliche, but young people are telling us, no adults in my life know my name, know anything about me. And then the third thing is known. And that's simply like, do you actually feel that this young person coming into your congregation, that anyone really knows them? I mean, we ask young people all the time, do you feel like the people in your life really know you? And if anyone in this podcast is following the theme of what I'm saying, the numbers are low, right? Like, and we everyone here on this call knows, it's one thing to be, and I hear this all the time, when you first meet someone, or if you don't know someone very well, you're meeting their PR representative, right? Like, you're meeting kind of the outside,
the best
version of them before they get in their car and tail someone on the way home and swear. But like, so for young people, it's, you know, and what we found too, is the more trusted adults a young person has in their life, the more of a sense of purpose they feel, the more of a sense of, I know why I'm here on this earth. I know why I've been put here. And again, I think older people, you know, count themselves out. They think, oh, young people just want to hang out with their friends. We don't realize how formidable it can be to actually like engage a young person, like actually engage with them, spend time with them, share things with them, be vulnerable with them. These are the things that they just don't have, and their mental health is suffering as a result.
This is important because you're naming two things. You're naming kind of belonging, and then relationships with people of other generations. And in the kind of belonging, the noticing, the naming, and the knowing, right?
Right.
And so that has an impact for people who work with young people, right, in ministry. Not just, they don't work to, right? They're not the object, they work with, they're empowering and being empowered by young people, the kind of noticing, the naming, and the knowing. But this other piece, which a lot of times when we do ministry, we say, you know what, let's just put another young person that's like them in the ministry. And so they're only relating with people of their own generation. But you're saying that the study shows that part of that kind of alienation or mental health challenges is because they're not relating with people from older generations or different
generations. Exactly. And again, you're not going to see this narrative in the media. What you're going to see is young people are dying and it's getting worse. Like, and it's, unfortunately, that's just not enough. That's not enough for faith leaders to feel any sense of directive.
Yeah, we need.
Yeah. So, So bringing it back a little bit to young people of color, because that's what navigating injustice is about.
That's right. Because that's another complexity, right? Because look, in optics, one of our phrases is we got to be the, like B'nai Yishakar, the sons and daughters of Issachar. We got to understand the time, but then we got to know what to do. So now it's you, young people writ large, but then there's a complexity of young people of color, young men and young women of color. How does that fill the narrative?
The biggest mistake that faith leaders and communities make is when they sit in that leadership meeting and they say things like, don't make this about race. That is the biggest mistake a church can make, because the second you tell people to leave race at home, you might as well tell them to stay home. And I'm talking specifically about young people of color.
Well, give me texture to that. How did the young people express that? The 3,000 young people of color express that in their faith conversation.
Imagine if a church said to you, if you're a Christian, stay home. How absurd would that sound? Right? Or don't bring real transformative faith into this context. We're the frozen chosen. We got cobwebs all over the baptismal. Like, stay home, leave real faith at home, right? The appearance of godliness, but denying its power.
Power.
Right. So we would say, like, that's absurd, right? take that same level of absurdity and apply it to, if you want to think about what it means for you to be Christian and Black, or Christian and Latino, or Christian and Asian, like, leave that at home. That is how absurd that sounds to a young person of color. And a lot, again, the big mistake is sort of extrapolating race and saying, politically speaking, this is not a safe idea. This is not a safe, or we just take it for granted, right? We use these, like, you know, like we're one people, we talked about before, sort of, you know, we don't want to divide people into Jew or Gentile or Greek or, you know, male, female. You know, God kind of reconciled those divisions in Christ. And gosh, that is such a mistake. The most common refrain we hear from young people is that, like, when I walk into a context and I don't feel like I am being challenged or inspired or encouraged to think about the relationship between my racial and religious identity, like, I don't feel like I belong. And here's the thing.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Because look, I think sometimes we make theological statements that are incomplete or misinformed, right?
They're truncated.
Right,
yes.
Right, because a theological truth that we are all reconciled in Christ does not obfuscate the sociological truth that, you know, we are different racially, different economically, right? Not even in the book of Revelation, right. You know, Revelation 7:9 says that John saw them from every tribe, nation, tongue, right? So even in the end, right, this is the eschaton, all things are reconciled, and John still sees the difference. I saw the differences.
Yes.
And so somehow we think that reconciliation means we obliterate differences. And that's kind of not, it's first
that's
of all,
a
not,
mental
not good
health.
Sociology. Correct. And it's definitely not good theology. It's not what the gospel says. You could still be a Jew. You could still be a Gentile. You could still be, you know, who you are in Christ and bring those differences to unity, but not uniformity. But the impact on mental health, you're saying, is devastating.
Is cannot be underestimated. I think that's why I said while you were talking, it is a mental health threat to the youngest members of your congregation to never ask them the question. Like, have you ever thought about, like, your background, your cultural or ethnic or racial background? And, like, what does that mean to you as a person of faith? Like, have you ever considered the relationship? Like, and that doesn't have to look like asking them in the lobby while they're stirring their coffee, right? Maybe it's something you bring up as a theme or a sermon series in youth group, like something that really engages the issue. My fear is that the evangelical church, in an effort to push back against identity politics, has swung so far the opposite direction that we don't want to look at anyone's identity. Because we're afraid that if we do, all of a sudden everyone's going to be a they, them or something. But it's like, we've got to find meaningful, authentic. But here's the thing. How can faith leaders do that best? They have to model it. And this is where older adults, and particularly those, you know, post like older than millennial generations can really struggle. Like, to be transparent and vulnerable about how they themselves have navigated the tension and the possibilities that come with, you know, racial, ethnic identity and faith.
Well, that's helpful. That's helpful, because what you're saying is, if we're going to empower these young people and embrace who God made them, we have to have a gospel theology of race.
Yes.
Right. Of culture. And the gospel is full of it. I mean, we just have to do the work. We have to know the gospel and how the gospel speaks. Tell me, did some of these young people share with you what the best practices, when they felt most empowered? Was that one of the questions? Like, what are the winning testimonials, for lack of it, or transformative testimonials?
I'm gonna read a quote that I think your audience is gonna love, and here's how it goes. This is from Isabella, so that's a pseudonym, that's not her real name, but she's 23 years old and identifies as Hispanic and Latino. She said, "My faith community brought me a lot of confidence and less anxiety," that's a key word there, anxiety, "regarding who I am and where I come from. They influenced me in a positive way by," this is important, "honoring my culture, my identity. Understanding my identity takes," listen, this is so key, "takes all the pressure off," she said. "I was more proud to be Latino. I didn't feel inferior. So yeah, I just love who I am and I love where I come from. My faith community has given me the confidence that I belong in this community and with Christ."
Wow.
Would people in your congregation say the same thing? Like, do they feel like their background is honored? Do they feel that's, and I love the incredible combination between, I feel honored as a Christian, I feel honored as a person of color. I feel honored for being Hispanic. And that is like, that connection cannot be parsed out. It is intimately connected.
Yeah, and it's the fullness of this young woman, pseudonym Isabella. And think about this, to celebrate her Hispanicity, her Latinidad, is not to not celebrate another person's Blackness or another right. person's Asianness, right? And so some people think that by celebrating difference, you necessarily create conflict.
Right.
But actually, the opposite could be true, where you're saying, because God loves every culture and every race, when you celebrate individual races, you're saying we can honor across the racial ethnic spectrum, the particularities, the difference, without creating kind of a hierarchy of race, right? Celebrating some, to say, hey man, I celebrate my oldest son, is not to say I don't celebrate my youngest son.
Right? That's right.
And so I think that we have to kind of do that work of celebrating a culture is not denigrating another
That's
culture.
Right.
And sometimes we get defensive around that.
Yes, it is. It's really unfortunate that I think the church in so many ways has been thrusted into this very politically charged debate around racial division and some of that in our country. And I think if our report shows anything, and if the audience is like, what's the point? Why should I pick up this report?
That's a great question.
It's because I think what you'll walk away with is you'll walk away with a totally flipped upside down understanding of how the topic of race and ethnicity in your faith context can be emboldening, confidence driving, momentum building for your congregation. It doesn't have to be a threat. It doesn't have to be something that you keep under wraps for the sake of unity in the church. It can be, I mean, there's another quote I would love to read to you that I think really helps to understand this connection. Let me find it here. Well, first of all, listen to this quote from, her name is Zion, African-American and Jamaican, age 20. She says, "I feel like Christianity and Blackness are the same thing. I don't see any difference between worshiping God as a Christian and worshiping God as a Black person. It is the same thing for me." Here's another quote. This is from someone, her name is May. She's Black and African-American, age 20. She said, "When churches or religious institutions fail to acknowledge that there are parts of people's identity that need to be addressed, it's just, you need to see them and hear their pain. It's from a place of extreme privilege for your church to never acknowledge the very real identities that are impacted by what's going on in the world today. It's not just on the news, it's real. It's in real people's lives. It's affecting them. To ignore race," this is the key, "is to ask people not to bring that part of themselves into the space." And then earlier on, she says, "I am the person who can't leave race outside of a space. Being Black shapes the way I think about things in a lot of ways and what I tend to think about. Religious or spiritual places are no exception," she says.
Well, and look, I think what you're saying here is that people bring their full selves. And this might have some application for people who are differently abled. You can't ignore that, right? Christ loves them, created them, empowers them, calls them to serve and lead, right? And you don't ignore differently abled people in the church. People who are elderly. You don't ignore that they're elderly and that their life experience brings something to bear. And well, if we don't ignore differently abled people, if we don't ignore generational differences, then we should say, hey, the gospel has something to say, but not just something to say. It embraces you. For what, you know, Jew, Greek, right? Wise, unwise, Paul says in Romans 1, that I'm a debtor to them all. Hey, you're in this program, Optics, with Dr. Gabe Salguero and Kevin Singer, in the nexus of faith and Hispanicity. And I was talking to Kevin before we went live, before we recorded this, and we're talking about, hey, Hispanics are young, they're a young community. You know, we're the youngest community. We're skewing a little older in the last few years, but we're still the youngest. One out of every four children born in the U.S. is Hispanic. One out of every two is a child of color. It's part of why we do Optics and part of why NALIC exists, to serve that growing, emerging voice in Christianity in America, Hispanic evangelicalism. We're young. We're bilingual, we're multiracial. I know Latino Asians, and I know Latinos, Black Latinos, and I know, you know, Latinos who are white and who come, their father's white and their mother's Hispanic. Like the whole, I myself pastor a Latino-led multi-ethnic and multicultural church, and that has its, it's a great, it's giftings, it's power, but you have to navigate that with wisdom. And I love the title of your research, Navigating Injustice.
Right.
Faith, race, yes, and mental health. What were the biggest tools the young people themselves said were for navigating this?
Yeah, that's critical. I think what your audience should consider is that, we love to say in church, and especially, you know, those in youth ministry, like one lock-in or one retreat can have the power of 1,000 sermons, right? And I think if we're honest, going back to earlier in our conversation, it's because it is so effective at creating a sense of belonging. Like, and I think even when we look back and we were young, like having that sense of belonging, I remember me and one of my friends had a lake house, and like we would go to his lake house and we would shoot fireworks all over the sky, and I got hit in the face with one time. Ooh. But that is something I'll never forget. Like that sense of belonging on the beach surrounding the campfire, right? Like, so to use that same idea, one meaningful conversation between a young person in your congregation and you about their experiences navigating, for example, racial injustice, and how their faith sort of formed around those experiences and maybe gave them hope in those experiences or helped them to understand those experiences, could be the equivalent of 6 books, right, on race and racial reconciliation. Like, I think if people walk away from this feeling any certain way or what they can do, it's just engage the conversation. And before you do it, reflect a little bit about how you yourself have navigated maybe racially unjust situations in your own life, using your faith as a tool to help you navigate those things. I think if you can identify how you've done it, you can speak to young people about how you've done it. They can take that wisdom from you and try to do the same thing.
Well, and so that's insightful, because what you're saying is you have to create the space. Create the space for grace for conversations. Most young people won't just come up and ask, if they're struggling with it. You have to create intentional space for the conversations. And what I think I hear the research saying, it has to be a multi-generational conversation.
It really does. And the other thing too, and this is something that you'll see in the news too, and it is true, is that young people don't trust institutions right now. There's a lot of distrust. That's why, you know, they don't watch polished videos anymore. They watch videos of people like in a sweatshirt. They look like they haven't showered in weeks, jumping up and down on TikTok. And they say, that is the funniest thing.
That's awesome.
They want it raw. They want it, you know, no filter. They want it because they can sense a lack of transparency from a mile away. And so that's something critical. A program at your church is not going to create a sense of belonging. A program is not going to help them see the connection between race and faith. A person has to do that.
Oh, that's good. The incarnation, right? I mean, yes. it's about-
And again, it's cliche. I've been in church planting, and I understand that's cliche. It's not programs that save people, right? Like, let's stop doing bigger and bigger programs. But what's funny is I think older adults still have a rather programmatic approach to reaching young people, where it's like, if we just get them in the door and they experience the program. But again, a program can't tell them the experiences you've had navigating race, mental health, and faith. Only
It's beyond event-driven. It's relationally driven. It's person-to-person.
We call it relational authority in Springtime, which is in comparison to institutional authority, right? So institutional authority is like, I'm an elder, I'm a pastor, I'm someone you should respect in our community. That does not reach young people the same way anymore. Like, it is relationship on the basis of which a young person says, they can tell me what to do. They can influence me. It's on the basis of relationship, not on the basis of pedigree or resume or how many generations or any of that stuff. It is, they want to know you are a real person who's faced real issues. If you can find a way to just tell a story to a young person about how you have felt pain, grief, where you've seen hope and you can be authentic about it, gosh, again, that's like a high school lock-in. You can make incredible strides with young people if you're willing to do that.
Well, and that's the power of testimony and lived experience, right? You're sharing your testimony. In my tradition, right, on Pentecostal, you know, men and women are in leadership. They share their story. The next generation hears it, interprets it, gives their story, that storytelling. That's important. Listen, you're on your program, Optics with Gabe Salguero. And today we have the gracious visit of Kevin Singer. He's part of the Springtide Research and their recent report, Navigating Injustice on Faith, Mental Health, and Race, particularly with people of color. We've seen a lot been written about people of color, a lot written about mental health, a lot written about faith, but you're talking about all three in this report. And before we leave, I just want to ask you two things. How can people access this report? How can leaders access this report? And what is your hope that they get from it? That's one. And then I want to ask you, what's your parting word of hope for optics?
Yeah, and I love that emphasis on hope. We are a people of hope. We are a people who live. We are a people of the day, right? And I lift my eyes up to the hills. Where does my hope come from, right? Hope comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And I love just simply the tone of this podcast. I love that it's iterative. It's, you know, what could the Lord be doing? What's the new song that the Lord is singing? I do feel like for young people of color in America in this day and age, that song is one of embracing the wholeness of who they are. And you've mentioned that already, Gabriel, in a really, I think, fantastic way earlier. You know, so there's something about the whole person being brought into a space and accepted that creates desperately that sense of belonging that most young people don't have anywhere in their lives, anywhere, right? They don't have it at home. They don't have it at church. They don't have it at school. And so you may have young people in your congregation who would say, yes, I don't know anyone who knows me. And so, man, like, I really hope that people sort of feel that in their bones, like what it might be like to not feel known intimately by anyone. But I'll say this, to access the report, obviously you can Google Springtide Navigating Injustice. That's a mouthful though. If you're a pastor, I would love to send you a copy of the report if you email me at kevin@springtideresearch.org. I'd love to get the report in your hands and the hands of your leadership team. If you want to do something bigger with the report, like, you know, bring it to a camp or a program, like, then we may have to look at maybe purchasing some of the reports. But if you're just like, I'm a pastor, I need to better understand this dynamic in the lives of young people, I'd love to just send you a copy of the report. And last word of hope, you know, Jesus is still working through his Spirit the same way that we saw on the day of Pentecost, right? Like God is still redeeming, restoring, and giving value and worth to people from all tongues, tribes, and nations. And I think that is the hope we have, is that young people are not seeing their race as something that is going to lead to trauma and discrimination. They are looking for opportunities to use their racial and ethnic identity for the glory of God and for the good of his kingdom. And I think if you could just see race and ethnicity in your context that way, as a tool that can be used by God to spread his fame and his glory all over the earth, I think there's endless possibilities of the great things God can do with that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are in your podcast, Optics, the intersection of faith and Hispanicity, faith and Latinidad. And we had the awesome visit of Kevin Singer sharing with us his reports from Springtide Research. That's not the only report they have, Navigating Injustice on Faith. They have reports on young people and mental health. And I encourage you to read it and enter into dialogue. And if you have questions, do email Kevin. Thanks for being a part of our program, Kevin.
You.
Thanks, Springtide, for this report that I'm sure will get into the hands of people who so desperately needed to respond to the issues of mental health and race and diversity. And so thanks for joining. And it'll be till the next time. En tu programa, Ópticas con el Dr. Gabriel Salguero, en el nexo de fe e hispanidad. Till the very next time, have a good one.